Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland from 2017, available at merchants-of-sin.com through, I think, Hulu or, what is it, Lulu and Amazon. You can get the book there. A couple hundred pages. We've already done two sessions. This will be the third. We'll do chapter 5, or V, from page 58 to 79. Chapter 5, as we dig in, is Psychoanalysis, Sexology, the Frankfurt School, and the New Left. So the Jews using psychology in order to figure out the supposed sexual motivations of human behavior and to produce the looseness they believe will make society, white society in particular, digestible to Jews. So again, Benjamin Garland, Merchants of Sin, Chapter 5, Psychoanalysis, Sexology, the Frankfurt School, and the New Left, end quote. Epigraph. Jews in America have been sexual revolutionaries. A large amount of the material on sexual liberation was written by Jews. Those at the forefront of the movement, which forced America to adopt a more liberal view of sex, were Jewish. And that's from Dr. Nathan Abrams, and he was, I believe, the key figure. No, I shouldn't say that, because it was a similar but different name, who was involved with the abortion legalization. So Jews are at the forefront of sexual liberation. As we know from audiobooks we've done on E. Michael Jones, he thought it important enough to include as a subtitle, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. He thought there was a direct link. This so-called sexual immorality, he would put it, is sold as liberation by the elite in order to control the people. Because personal discord in your sexual life, married life, etc., it's all related, leads to messed up people who are not in position to challenge the powers that be in creating the kind of society that actually works for them rather than for the Jew elite. The single most important figure in the sexualization of the West was the self-described, quote, fanatical Jew, Sigmund Freud. The single most important figure in the sexualization of the West was Freud. Freud was born to Galician Jews, some of the nastiest type of Jews, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1856. So he was born about 30 years before Hitler. And from the age of 4 lived in Vienna, which is loaded with Jews. And that's where Hitler came to know the truth about Jews from living in Vienna after he came from his small town. And so from the age of 4, Freud lived in Vienna, where he would develop the theories of, quote, psychoanalysis and found the psychoanalytic movement. By 1906, all 17 members of the psychoanalytic movement were strongly identified Jews, giving psychoanalysis the well-earned reputation of being a, quote unquote, Jewish science. Freud evidently saw himself at war with the Gentile world, frequently comparing himself to his role model, the Semitic general who went to war with Rome, Hannibal. He considered all Gentiles as anti-Semites, once saying, quote, basically all are anti-Semites. They are everywhere. Frequently anti-Semitism is latent and hidden, but it is there. So again, this prefigures the authoritarian personality, the so-called academic study the Jews had come up, you know, decades later, decades after Freudianism has become a known thing in the very early 1900s. And Jews believe that all whites in basic personality are authoritarian. So they're all budding Nazis. And flip side of that, they're all budding Jews. Imagine defining a gigantic race of people, much larger than the Jews, defining them by their attitude toward Jews. But all the Jew cares about is himself, and nothing has any relation or meaning. So if you spend your life criticizing the Jews and defending your own people, you're defined not by what you do or anything else. You're defined by your attitude towards Jews. So that if you looked me up on, say, Wikipedia or something, they would say you're an anti-Semite. So that defines you. You're not pro-white. You're not a writer or activist or anything else. You're defined. The most significant thing about you is your attitude toward the Jews. And that holds for all people in the world. That's part of what Jewish control of the media and the brain centers, academia and politics and government and education and the media, that's what it means. The Jewish privilege is that everything is refined or everything is defined in relation to your group, your small group. So Freud believed basically all Gentiles are anti-Semites. They are everywhere. Frequently, anti-Semitism is latent and hidden, but it is there. Freud claimed, without any real evidence, that humans are sexual from birth, that we all want to have sex with our parents, and, most importantly, that the sexual repression of children leads to neuroses and other mental illnesses later in life. There's a picture of Sigmund Freud. All liberalizations in sexual guidelines can be traced back to Freud's theories to one degree or another. For instance, anti-obscenity lawyer Edward DeGrazia, G-R-A-Z-I-A, anti-obscenity lawyer Edward DeGrazia wrote that the first significant liberalizing landmark case on obscenity, the 1933 Ulysses decision, discussed in part one, was a, quote, brave undertaking, one that only the spread of Freud's new ideas on human sexuality and unconscious could have induced grown men, at least if they were judges, to engage in. So without Freud, no court decisions liberalizing the obscenity laws, said Edward DeGrazia. The first journal dedicated to, quote, sexology, which attempts to rationalize perversion under the guise of science, featured an article penned by Freud in 1908. The publisher of the journal was the Jew Magnus Hirschfeld, the, quote, Einstein of sex, who would go on to co-found the first sexology clinic with Ivan Bloch, I-W-A-N, but in W is V in German, known as the father of sexology, and Albert Eulenberg, E-U-L-E-N-B-E-R-G, in 1913. So Ivan Bloch or Ivan Bloch and Albert Eulenberg and Magnus Hirschfeld, these are German Jew perverts in Germany who are setting up so-called scientific institutes that are really more bordellos. And like I've said, you want to read Kevin MacDonald and E. Michael Jones for further explanation of this stuff, and also John Murray Cudahy's The Ordeal of Civility deals with this as well, deals a lot with Freud. The second clinic of this nature, so we have the second clinic of this nature was founded just months later by their rival Albert Moll, M-O-L-L, and editorship of Hirschfeld's journal was turned over to Max Marcuse. All were Jews, says Garland in italics. All were Jews. And there's a picture of Magnus Hirschfeld. Spectacles. Big mustache. Bow tie. He was a queer. Associated with Weimar Germany and the communists, and they would keep files on the Nazis were filled with lies and made-up stuff that would later be used in the pink swastika, and when Hitler came to power, they went in and shut them down. In 1919, Hirschfeld founded the Institute for Sexology, the first of its kind, in Berlin, and this became the internationally recognized center of sexology research. There was a museum of sex perversions inside, which, according to Christopher Isherwood, he's a British homo who went over to Germany for the fat young boys, let's say. There was a museum of sex perversions inside, which, according to Christopher Isherwood, a homosexual author with a taste for young boys who had visited there, was filled with, quote, whips and chains and torture instruments designed for the practitioners of pleasure gain, high-heeled, intricately decorated boots for the fetishists, lacy undies which had been worn by ferociously masculine Prussian officers beneath their uniforms. So said Christopher Isherwood. The Institute was adorned with portraits of transvestites and carried out the first, quote, sex change operations. Indeed, the now widely known concept of transgenderism comes directly from Hirschfeld. It was originally called, quote, transsexualism. So that's where all this modern USA garbage that came in. As soon as they got homosexual marriage in law in most of the states, the Jew mainstream media, the Jewstream media, turned to promoting transgenderism. Well, this is where it comes from. Magnus Hirschfeld, a German Jew queer, even before 1920. Hirschfeld also lobbied for 30 years to overturn Germany's famous Paragraph 175 law, which criminalized sodomy and staged the first Congress for, quote, homosexual rights. Hitler, as leader of the rising National Socialist Party, while the Institute for Sexology was thriving, called Hirschfeld, quote, the most dangerous Jew in Germany. Direct quote from Hitler on Magnus Hirschfeld, this Jew queer who founded the Institute for Sexology, that E. Michael Jones, I believe it was, said it was basically a homosexual bordello. And Hitler called Hirschfeld the most dangerous Jew in Germany. On a speaking tour when Hitler came to power in 1933, Hirschfeld self-exiled, knowing full well he was no longer welcome back in his former host country. He died 2 years later while in France. So he died in 1935. He set up his institute in 1919. On May 6, 1933, the institute was raided by National Socialist students. They carried off a bust of Hirschfeld and some 10,000 books, articles, and documents, and burned them in a giant bonfire, symbolically and literally cleansing their nation of Jewish poison. Most of the photos of the Nazis burning books are of the Hirschfeld bonfire. Jews being at the heart of the pseudo-scientific justifications for the sexualization of society follows logically with their historic overrepresentation as pimps, pornographers, and sex offenders, as well as the sexually and morally subversive nature of their, quote, activities in the press, in art, in theater, and literature, as Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf, My Struggle. After struggling for years to come to terms with the Jewish question and rejecting the anti-Semitic literature of his time as, quote, too sensational to be true, unquote, this highly unsavory aspect of the Jews is what finally turned Hitler against them. Block quote from Hitler. All unctuous protests were now more or less futile. One needed only to look at the posters announcing the hideous productions of the cinema and theater, and study the names of the authors who were highly lauded there in order to become permanently adamant on Jewish questions. Here was a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public was being infected. It was worse than the Black Plague of long ago. And in what mighty doses this poison was manufactured and distributed. The fact that 9/10 of all the smutty literature, artistic tripe, and theatrical banalities had to be charged to the account of people who formed scarcely 1% of the nation, that fact could not be gainsaid. It was there, and it had to be admitted. That was Hitler. And then there's a photo with the caption, other books burned by the National Socialist included those of Sigmund Freud and Wilhelm Reich. And there's a giant bonfire and people standing around it in a ring, in a mass. Moving on to 63. Although Hirschfeld's operation was shut down in 1933, its successor, the Kinsey Institute, headed by the sadomasochistic homosexual psychopath Alfred Kinsey, opened up shop in America in 1938 and went to work subverting the sexual morality of America by faking statistical data. In 1948, Alfred Kinsey's book, Sexuality in the Human Male, was unleashed into American discourse like a malicious virus. The book was made up of data collected through alleged interviews of subjects, quote, sexual histories, using a questionnaire largely based on the one that had been used by Hirschfeld. So this so-called pseudo-intellectual work transfers from Germany, since the German nationalists take power, to America via the carrier of the Jew, even though there are non-Jews involved. Kinsey was not a Jew. It made an incredible amount of outrageous claims, the Kinsey Institute and their study that was widely popularized in the Jewish media. It's not that Jews invent everything or think everything up, but they have the mechanism that decides what gets amplified, like Kinsey, or muffled, like good nationalist stuff. And anyway, the Kinsey's book, Sexuality in the Human Male, was his first one. It made an incredible amount of outrageous claims, such as that 50% of men cheated on their wives, 69% had used prostitutes, 67 to 97% had premarital sex, 37% had, quote, more than one male in three, as Kinsey gleefully put it, had a homosexual experience. And 50% of farm boys had sex with animals. So Kinsey is simply lying in the name of science. And you see, Jews have a pattern. If they can't sell their lies outright, they love to dress them up in the drag of science. Global warming is just one example, and the latest, but it's not the first. Marxism was probably the first, because Marx pretended that his claims about history were science. But here they're selling lies about Americans' average, typical, normal sexual behavior. They have simply made up lies and are trying to pass them off as research and science. The book was a runaway hit, selling an astonishing 200,000 copies in just 2 months. Quote, not since Gone with the Wind had booksellers seen anything like it, noted Time magazine. Kinsey took Freud's theories of child sexuality to the extreme. It has been assumed, quote, that infants are sexual, Kinsey wrote, citing Freud and the psychoanalysts. But he goes on, there are few specific data to prove it. So he and his team set out to do just that, to, quote, prove that infants are sexual. They proceeded to sexually molest innumerable children and then carefully documented and wrote about it openly and in great detail. Now see, E. Michael Jones goes into this a bunch, but yeah, he literally, you have these big foundations like Rockefeller are founding literal child molestation and child rape and then recording it on film and on radio, and that's their research. That's the basis of the science and the statistics they draw. And he interviewed all kinds of prostitutes and people in jail. E. Michael Jones goes into it in great length, but really all you need to know is they're faking. They're trying to move reality by lying about reality. They want an open, unstrung, sexually promiscuous, loose society, so they lie that that's how people really are anyway, even when they're not, in order to change American sexual behavior. And look what's happened in the 60, 70 years since this. The pedophiles sexually stimulated the children and then recorded what they thought when they thought the children had, quote, orgasms. One of Kinsey's conclusions drawn from this, quote, research was that, and I'm not making this up, says Garland, quote, it is probable that half or more of the boys in an uninhibited society could reach climax by the time they were 3 or 4 years of age, unquote. In 1953, Kinsey released his second report, Sexuality in the Human Female, in which he unsurprisingly made similar outrageous claims. And then there's a nearly full-page graphic, the caption of which, one of the many charts in sexual behavior in the human male, which documents the Kinsey Institute's systematic sexual abuse of children, inspired by Freud's teachings about, quote, infantile sexuality. So they're trying to prove that basically every human being from the moment of birth is completely sexual and can orgasm and you shouldn't repress it in any way. And yeah, so this chart is pre-adolescent experience in orgasm. Age when observed, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, five, I mean, all the way up to 12 months. So, I mean, think, and no one questioned, like, how are you getting data on sub-1-year-olds orgasming? I mean, what kind of sick fuckery is that? I mean, that's literally criminal behavior documented and sitting there. Because it can't be known except by criminal means. These reports were a necessary prerequisite for the sexual revolution. Here was seemingly credible scientific data, very well funded and heavily promoted. Like I said, a lot of the major foundations were behind it, that claimed the majority of Americans were already secretly sexual degenerates. And that, as Charles Socarides, MD, put it, quote, all types of sexual activity, sex with the opposite sex, sex with the same sex, sex with both sexes, sex with children, sex with whips and chains, fisting sex with animals, any kind of sex was normal and common. Charles Socarides, MD. Jewish anti-obscenity law activists and, quote, sex reformers immediately sprang into action to capitalize on Kinsey's bogus data, which, taken at face value, showed that 95% of males and 80% of females were guilty of punishable sex crimes. So they're going to say we have to change the law to fit their actual behavior, even though their actual behavior is based on lies masquerading as science, promoted as science. You see the game being played. That's the learning here that needs to happen in your brain. You see how they use science. So the fact that someone says something, oh, well, that's science. I fucking love science. Well, you have to make sure that science actually is science. Because a lot of stuff that masquerades as science is not science. And if Fib fooled the child, it always pops up in my head as he's describing the Grinch fooling Cindy Lou Who's too. The sad part is people who are 22 or 82 are just as easily taken in as Cindy Lou who is no more than two. America's most prominent, so basically they're saying that, look, like virtually all men and the vast majority of women are doing things that are outlawed right now. So how absurd and hypocritical are we as a society? We need to change the law to reflect our actual behavior. But the hidden motive is to destroy white society's morals, destroy its idea of itself, to change it, to radically alter it in a way that makes it digestible, as I always say, for Jews. You see? Bad for whites equals good for Jews. America's most prominent anti-obscenity figure of the time, the ACLU's Morris Ernst, discussed further in Part 1, who was also Kinsey's lawyer, co-wrote a book based on the Kinsey reports with another Jew, David Goldstein Loth, L-O-T-H, called American Sexual Behavior and the Kinsey Report. In this book, which was published the very same year as Sexuality in the Human Male, that would be 1948, Ernst and Loth advocated for the repeal of all of the 52 existing sex crime laws. They claimed that, quote, virtually every page of the Kinsey Report touches some section of the legal code, and thus the law, quote, falls lamentably short of being based on a knowledge of the facts. Herbert Wexler, a Jew who served on the judge's panel at Nuremberg, then introduced Kinsey's, quote, data, unquote, to the law community at large with his 1952 article in the Harvard Law Review, quote, The Challenge of a Model Penal Code, where he argued that the incarceration rate for sex criminals was way too high. Weakening, softening society, hiding behind the mask of science. Wexler went on to become the director of the American Law Institute, the ALI, and was the chief reporter on its drafting of the 1955 Model Penal Code, MPC. The ALI-MPC called for the reduction of penalty, or outright abolition, of all sex-based laws, such as those against sodomy, homosexuality, oral sex, prostitution, adultery, and bestiality. It was adopted all or in part in every state over the next 2 decades, and all of its footnotes regarding the sex laws, without exception, cite the Kinsey reports as the sole evidence for the need to liberalize them. And you'd also think of it in a totally different area, the pretext given by something like 911 in order, they have weapons of mass destruction, so they dummy up some stupid report presented at the United Nations, knowing that it's a lie, knowing that it's based on false data, but in order to obtain the policy they want. In the sex stuff, it's the change of the sex laws to unstring society. In the other one, it's to justify aggressive foreign wars to reorder the Middle East for the good of Israel. Everything is done for what's good for Jews, and they have no problem at all lying in order to obtain their results. It's basically their by way of deception is their main MO. It's their method of operation. And then there's a picture of Herbert Wexler with Jewish Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a couple of hideous, nasty-looking old Jews. The Jew Gershon Legman, L-E-G-M-A-N, called Kinsey's work, quote, statistical hokum, crafted for the, quote, propagandistic purpose of respectabilizing homosexuality and certain other perversions. Given the source, this is a pretty incredible statement. Legman was one of Kinsey's assistants and was himself a significant figure in the sexualization of America, even taking credit for the slogan, quote, make love, not war. He had also worked as an assistant to Samuel Roth, discussed in Part 3, and was an associate of Frederick Wortham in his crusade against comic books, discussed in Part 2. So all these Jews are a tightly related nest of criminals and liars. Quote, Legman is the person, more than any other, who made research into erotic folklore and erotic verbal behavior academically respectable. A Professor Jackson is quoted in the New York Times as saying, quote, he's utterly famous in the world of erotica for what he did, for making these materials accessible by providing them freely to anyone who asked, and for finding stuff that nobody else knew about. And the Kinsey Institute had a gigantic collection of smut, essentially. The online Jewish publication Tablet writes of Legman, quote, Mr. Legman is best known as the author of a 2-volume psychoanalytic study of sexual and scatological humor titled Rationale of the Dirty Joke, and as an anthologist of limericks. He also published books on violence in comic books, oral sex, and aspects of erotic folklore. He accumulated what has been described as one of the world's largest collections of published and unpublished erotic and scatological literature. In interviews, he also said he had developed a vibrator in the late 1930s and coined the phrase, make love, not war, during a talk at the University of Ohio in 1963. Legman claimed that some classmates wrote the word kosher with horseshit juice on his forehead when he was a child. The lasting impression of this, presumably fabricated, event is what led him, he further claimed, to what became a lifelong dedication to the Freudian belief that the suppression of sex leads to violence and anti-Semitism. In 1949, he published a book titled Love and Death, in which he used this bizarre Freudian logic to make a case for the liberalization of obscenity laws. Legman's book, Josh Lambert assures us in Unclean Lips, Obscenity, Jews, and American Culture, quote, not now widely read, was hardly obscure. And now that it was post-World War II, Legman's argument had a powerful lever. Love and Death derives much of its rhetorical force and impetus from the Holocaust. His stated purpose was to advocate the repeal of American obscenity laws, and the genocide of the Jews motivated him in that project and provided him with useful evidence. So that, I mean, they even go so far in their own minds and putting out even to us is that if we don't make society sexually liberal, we're going to have a resurgence of Nazis and the Jews, 6 million more Jews will be killed. All lies, all lies. Everything Jews say is a lie. Legman, and there's a big photo of him. He's a goofy looking Jew. Thick with kind of crazy hair. Legman was far from alone in the contention that sexual liberation would make the world safer for Jews, and that the Holocaust could be used as leverage in this regard. In Unclean Lips, Lambert gives us details on many other Jews who thought this way, such as Abraham Maslow and Albert Ellis, who were two of the most influential Freudian psychologist/sexology thinkers, and Ludwig Lewison, who, Lambert writes, was, quote, by far the most prominent Jewish writer in interwar America, indicating just how mainstream this point of view is among the Jewish community. In 1923, a group of Freudo-Marxist Jews founded the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, Germany. A decade later, when Hitler came to power, the Institute shut down and they were forced out of Germany. They came to America and resumed their work at Columbia University in New York and became known as the Frankfurt School. The Frankfurt School developed what is known as critical theory. Critical theory is basically an overt Jewish intellectual assault on the Western world, done under the guise of high-minded idealism and weaponized pseudo-morality. Critical theory. It works to tear down, criticize, and, quote, deconstruct all of Western civilization and culture by purporting to show how it is inherently and historically racist, misogynistic, anti-Semitic, homophobic, etc. In essence, it is the Jewish reverse engineering of civilization with sexual morality that civilization has been built on as a primary target for deconstruction, as the Freudian notion of sexual repression is frequently claimed to be at the root of many of the world's problems. So they unstring society by loose sex, destroy families that exist, prevent families from forming by driving kids into homosexuality, into loose, promiscuous, womb-destroying sexual diseases that come from promiscuity, emotional problems that accompany having huge numbers of partners. I saw a graphic within the last couple weeks that showed that women's neuroticism, the ideal number of sexual partners for them is one. They have higher neuroticism if they have none. They have lower, they have like 50, 40 if they have one, and then back over 50 if they have two, and then going up from there. So that shows you they're basically meant to be mated and pair bonded is the best situation psychologically for women. Somewhat less true for men, just owing to the nature of masculinity versus femininity, sperm being cheap and eggs being dear. Now, so all this pseudo-academic work, the pseudoscience is all under the umbrella of this critical theory meant to destroy the West. And rather than admit, yeah, we're out here to destroy the West, they claim to be offering academic interpretations of what's going on. So again, more false science, false social science, and false physical science. The 1947 book, Dialectic of Enlightenment, by the Jews Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, two of the big names of the Frankfurt School, described as being, quote, undoubtedly the most influential publication of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, the 1947 book Dialectic of Enlightenment, again, and the Kinsey stuff came out in 48. The Dialectic of Enlightenment by Adorno and Horkheimer portrays anti-Semitism as a mental illness in Gentiles. Jewish behavior never figures into the equation, of course, and claims that civilization itself is repressive and evil. Quote, in sexuality's better pre-patriarchal past, before civilization, capitalism, and Christianity, human beings lived in harmony without sexual repression or inequality, they claim, noting approvingly of, quote, primitive orgies. It's all lies. The, quote, National Socialist terror, it is alleged to be shown in Dialectic of Enlightenment, quote, was not an aberration of modern history, but was rooted deeply in the fundamental characteristics of Western civilization. So they're going to use the lies they made up that got people to kill the Nazis to destroy now not just National Socialist Germany, but to destroy the entire West. The Frankfurt School Jews are most well known for writing the Authoritarian Personality, part of the Studies in Prejudice series, which was funded by the American Jewish Committee. The Authoritarian Personality pathologized everyone with even slightly right-leaning views. Read the vast majority of all people in human history. And there's a picture of the skulking, hulking Jew, Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno. They're all glasses-wearing old Jews, bald old Jews, or just little brushes of hair on them. The most destructive people in history. They came up with the F scale, which supposedly measures people's fascistic tendencies. Anyone included in the study who displayed either a concern with sexual morality, distrust toward Jews, or a traditional view on gender roles gets a high rating on the F scale and is portrayed as mentally ill. Their sickness, these Jews claim, most likely stems from sexual repression, closet homosexuality, and authoritarian upbringing. And they probably have deep-seated, quote, sadomasochistic, unquote, tendencies. And they are probably just projecting their own frustrations and insecurities onto weaker people in order to make themselves feel better. Scapegoating. Pretty vicious stuff, to be sure, says Garland, but this is what much of our universities, namely the social sciences, believe and teach. And this obviously has a very real effect on how our society views and treats sexuality. Quote, no volume published since the war in the field of social psychology has had a greater impact on the direction of the actual empirical work being carried on in the universities today, reads a quote on the book's Wikipedia page. So this is tremendously, this dominates the academy. This view that whites and Western culture are inherently sick and they need to be destroyed by Jews in the name of liberation, because all whites are budding Nazis. And just as we destroyed the Nazis, we need to essentially destroy ourselves. There's a graphic of the Authoritarian Personality, kind of the title page, by T.W. Adorno, Elsa Frankel Brunswick, Daniel J. Levinson, R. Nevitt Sanford, in collaboration with an Aaron Levinson and a William Morrow. Studies in Prejudice, edited by Max Horkheimer and Samuel H. looks like Flowerman, Harper and Brothers, New York. So that's the big book. That's the basis of this. All of the above helped lay the intellectual groundwork for the sexual revolution that was carried out by the 1960s counterculture, which was led politically by the New Left. Jews in general were vastly overrepresented among the New Left radicals and intellectuals, despite comprising only around 2% of the American population. Professor Ernest Vandenhaag, he was an old National Review familiar, longtime writer, wrote in his 1969 book, Did Vandenhaag, and he was a Jew, The Jewish Mystique, 1969, quote, although very few Jews are radicals, very many radicals are Jews. Out of 100 Jews, 5 may be radicals, but out of 10 radicals, 5 are likely to be Jewish. As we flip on to page 72, Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, was the premier New Left group. At its peak in 1968, the SDS had around 100,000 known members in 400 chapters. Scholars have estimated that over 60% of its leadership and 30 to 50% of its rank and file membership nationwide were Jews. So the SDS was the main New Left and it was led by Jews. Some more focused studies turned up even higher percentiles. For instance, a study conducted at the University of California found that 83% of leftist radicals had Jewish backgrounds, and one at the University of Michigan, a full 90%. The true figures, it must be noted, were actually even higher, as many racially Jewish leftists passed themselves off as, quote, atheists. quote, smash monogamy became one of the New Left's revolutionary battle cries. The Jewish leader of SDS, Mark Rudd, wrote of the rampant sexual degeneracy that was being unleashed by these radicals in his book, Underground, My Life with the SDS and the Weathermen. Quote, it was a moment of extreme sexual experimentation. Group sex, homosexuality, casual sexual hookups were all tried as we attempted to break out of the repression of the past into the revolutionary future. On one ride from Chicago to Detroit, all 14 or so of us, except perhaps the driver, writhed naked on the floor of the van while hurtling down the interstate, legs, arms, torsos, genitals interlocked with no particular identity attached. The Frankfurt School Jew who had by far the most direct influence on the sexual revolution was Herbert Marcuse. Marcuse was nicknamed the father of the New Left. During the 1968 leftist riots in France, which nearly toppled its conservative president Charles de Gaulle, students carried banners with the slogan, Marx, Mao, Marcuse. There's a big picture on 73 of Mark Rudd, the Jew, leader of the SDS. David Allen, A-L-L-Y-N, writes in his book on the history of the sexual revolution, Make Love, Not War, quote, for young radicals, the idea in Herbert Marcuse's Eros and Civilization, 1955, were the cornerstone of the sexual revolution. Marcuse's writings on sexual liberation were very, very strange. They were based largely on Freud's fantastical theory of, quote, polymorphous perversity. This is the theory that children are sexual from birth, and receive sexual or, quote, erotic pleasure from all parts of their body until they are, quote, repressed by society. This happens at around 5 years old, and afterwards their sexuality becomes centralized in their sexual organ, and they get amnesia about their prior state of polymorphous perversity. Freud himself wasn't a sexual liberationist, though. He believed that the suppression of sexuality is necessary in order for civilization to exist. He wrote, in Civilization and Its Discontents, that, quote, it is impossible to overlook the extent to which civilization is built up upon a renunciation of instinctual gratifications. It's built on self-control, not liberation. Marcuse disagreed with this sentiment and argued that since civilization had reached such a level of comfort and affluence, it could withstand the releasing of sexual passion and a return to this polymorphous perversity. His theoretical sexual utopia would result, he wrote, in a, quote, reactivation of all erotogenic zones and, so not just the genitals, but the whole body, whole mind, and consequently in a resurgence of pregenital polyamorous sexuality. And this would make, quote, the body in its entirety an instrument of pleasure. One could hardly get more abstract than that, says Garland. There's a picture of Herbert Marcuse, another balding, aged, liver-spotted, nasty old Jew. In a nutshell, as alt-right blogger Vincent Law put it, Marcuse's platform was, quote, a promise of a utopia of sex on demand, and every single perversity of every single individual fulfilled on the grounds of it being grounded in their childlike innocence. Unquote. So basically everything goes is what we need to do, is what Marcuse is saying. Using the conflict in Vietnam as their linchpin, Marcuse, the New Left, and the counterculture sexual revolutionaries made Legman's, quote, make love, not war, the motto and attitude of the day. Quote, when we chanted make love, not war, my draft-resisting friends and I were echoing the words of Frankfurt School theorists, feminist professor Linda Williams wrote in the book Sex Scene, giving a first-hand account of her time with the New Left. Quote, sparked by Marcuse, turned on by music, marijuana, and psychedelics, outraged by the escalations of a war whose injustice was driven home by a draft that affected the entire population of young men, my generation really did think, at least for a moment, that making love could be a political act against war. The most radical of all New Left groups was the Yippies, slang for Youth International Party, the political manifestation of the hippies, founded and led by two Jews, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. The Yippies were heavily promoted in the media at the time and encouraged the most extreme forms of nation-wrecking hedonism imaginable. Before protesting the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which famously got eight of them arrested and put through a high-profile trial for conspiracy to incite riots, they publicly joked about pouring LSD in the water supply and declared, quote, "We will fuck in the beaches. We demand the politics of ecstasy. Abandon the creeping meatball." And all the time, yippee! Jerry Rubin wrote a book called Do It, which was widely distributed among college campuses and featured an introduction written by Black Panther icon Eldridge Cleaver, who had previously admitted to raping white women out of racial hatred in his book Soul on Ice. Cleaver was a hero to the New Left and the counterculture, not in spite of being a rapist of white women, but precisely because he was a rapist of white women, as hard of a pill as that is to swallow. He wrote, quote, Rape was an insurrectionary act. It delighted me that I was defying and trampling upon the white man's law, upon his system of values, and that I was defiling his women. I felt I was getting revenge. From the sight of the act of rape, consternation spread outwardly in concentric circles. I wanted to send waves of consternation throughout the white race. And then there's a picture of a black wearing some kind of prosthetic penis outside his pants and a bunch of white clothing models, not people, but a mannequin is what I mean to say. And the caption reads, "White raping hero of the Jewish counterculture, Eldridge Cleaver, also unironically invented penis pants." Rubin was as mentally insane as a Jew can be, and with the help of the Jewish-dominated media, he injected his insanity into the 60s generation by making it hip, quote-unquote. He told people in a speech to be prepared to, quote, "kill your parents," because they, quote, "are our first oppressors." He called his own mother a, quote, "white-skinned, no-good, sexless asshole, cap-toothed, cancerous venom of a snake who destroyed me from birth," close quote. Quote, "How can you separate politics from sex?" he queried in one of the more outrageous chapters of Do It, titled Fuck God. "It's all the same thing. Colon, body politic." And then a block quote from him, a long one. From Jerry Rubin, the Jew, the radical. "Politico-sexual reality. The naked human body is immoral under Christianity and illegal under American, with a K, law. Nudity is called indecent exposure. Fuck is a dirty word because you have to be naked to do it. Also, it's fun. When we start playing with our, quote, private parts, our parents say, quote, don't do that. The mother commits a crime against her child when she says, don't do that. We're taught that our shit stinks. We're taught to be ashamed of how we came into the world, fucking. We're taught that if we dig balling, we should feel guilty. We're taught body pleasure is immoral. We're really taught to hate ourselves. Puritanism leads us to Vietnam. Sexual insecurity results in a super masculinity trip called imperialism. American foreign policy, especially in Vietnam, makes no sense except sexually. America has a frustrated penis trying to drive itself into Vietnam's tiny slit to prove it is the man." This crescendo of subversive Jewish filth climaxes with Rubin's following declaration. Quote, "Our tactic is to send niggers and long-haired scum invading white middle-class homes, fucking on the living room floor, crashing on the chandeliers, spewing sperm on the Jesus pictures, breaking the furniture, and smashing Sunday school napalm blood America forever." It's a shame that such blatant assaults on the foundation of our society were tolerated, but here we are. The main reason they weren't opposed properly is because they were coming from Jews, and atrocity stories had catapulted the Jews virtually to an untouchable status following World War II. Anyone who would dare criticize the Jews would be ostracized from polite society and relegated to the absolute fringes of politics because they would be seen to be just like the Nazis, who the world now hated with a fiery passion. We'll conclude this segment with a quote from one of the few who were brave enough to speak out, Dr. William Pierce, who witnessed the Jewish counterculture upheaval firsthand while working as a physics professor at Oregon State University in the 1960s. Block quote from Pierce. During the Vietnam conflict, the Jewish leaders of Students for a Democratic Society, Americans for Democratic Action, the National Student Association, the Student Mobilization Committee, and 100 other leftist organizations were using the war as a pretext to turn American society upside down. These groups had virtually taken over the university campuses in America because the university administrators were afraid that they would be accused of anti-Semitism if they took a stand against them. And remember, all the leaders and a lot of the members were Jews, most of the leaders. And the trendy airheads on the campuses, who had been spoiled rotten by a permissive upbringing, easily fell for the propaganda of these organizations, which essentially told them that they could do whatever they wanted to and had no responsibility to anyone or anything. The full extent to which the Jews are responsible for the sexual revolution, this is Garland again, and the sexualization of our culture is impossible to gauge, of course, but as the above evidence, which only scratches the surface, and as I said, find E. Michael Jones, John Murray Cudahy, William Pierce, and Kevin MacDonald if you want to know more and more academic stuff. He's absolutely right. You could make it as deep as you want, as broad as you want. Shows their contribution was enormous. Jews sexualized the culture to make it good for Jews and knowing that it would destroy us, because destroying us is good for them. This fact is going to have to be reckoned with if we ever hope to reverse the damage these sexual revolutionaries have caused. No history of sexual liberation would be complete, though, without discussing the Jew Wilhelm Reich, from whom the term sexual revolution comes, and second-wave feminism, which was one of the main driving forces. These will be the topics of Part 6 and Part 7. So that will end our session for today, essentially, how the Jews used fake science, specifically sexual science, to revolutionize society and really to destroy it. Very horrible, awful story that is taught in no school, but you learn only here at the Learning College from honest men like Benjamin Garland, author of Merchant of Sin. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you for more from Merchants of Sin real soon.